Data centers, electric vehicles, and rapid electrification are driving unprecedented growth in electricity demand across the United States. The questions are, can the grid keep up? And can utilities keep pace with changing flexibility requirements while ensuring optimal network utilization? To answer these questions and to unpack the growing challenges surrounding grid congestion, I speak with Nick Chassett, CEO of Octopus Energy US. He explores why flexibility may just be as important as new generation, how large energy users can become part of the solution, and why smart software, energy storage, and regulatory reform will be critical to building a cleaner, more affordable energy system. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Nick, thank you so much for joining me today. We're talking about grid congestion in the US. And some people argue that the biggest constraint actually is not generation, but grid capacity and flexibility. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's a bit of everything, right? And it's going to be somewhat market specific, but absolutely. The challenge, I think, is fundamentally best understood in the context of you have 8,760 hours a year. And as load is growing so fast, the mismatch is specific hours during the year being mismatched between supply and demand and capacity in the network to serve versus demand for supply. And so that mismatch is, to me, sort of the clearest and simplest articulation, because when you think about it from an hourly perspective, it also helps you to sort of contextualize the types of solutions that you need to think about, right? Generation certainly is a solution. Building more generation allows for a better match between supply and demand, but also reducing consumption elsewhere in a network gives you an equal solution, right? Because you're just trying to find that balance between supply and demand in, you know, every second, minute, 15-minute interval, hour, and above. The congestion dynamic, right, gets to the more localized nature of the challenge, that you have that supply-demand dynamic that is magnified within a specific subsection of your network. And again, I think that's right, that it is a big challenge, especially as you have these big point source loads that are coming online. If you think about a 500-megawatt or 1,000-megawatt data center that might be coming online, it creates a cascading of challenges from the very localized challenge within that sort of substation area or that specific point of interconnection to the transmission system, all the way up to the entire system where you have to maintain that balance. So I would say it's yes and.
Nick, what do you believe are the biggest drivers of grid congestion in the US today? And how has it changed over the last few years?
I think the place you have to start that question is with load growth, because we have just seen a level of new load coming online over the last 5 years that's fairly unprecedented. You really have to go back to the 1960s when you have post-World War II economic boom to see the level of change in demand and new load coming online. That sort of industrialization that we were seeing across the United States during that period is really only matched by today. And so a lot of it is data center and the massive demand for data center, but it's not simply data center. The electrification trend really can't be denied as well. You know, as much as the news coverage globally might be that, you know, demand for electric vehicles in the United States is slowing, we're still seeing, you know, millions of EVs being deployed every single year. And, you know, every EV is somewhat equivalent to a new home, right? So, you know, a home has a demand of X, it buys an EV, now it's 2X, two EVs, 3X. So we really are seeing a level of growth, particularly in places like California with electric vehicles, where you have north of, you know, 1.5, 2 million electric vehicles on the road. You know, that looks like massive population growth. So electric vehicles are a big part of it as well. And then just general economic dynamism and growth in the economy. The US economy in the last 5 years has grown a lot. Advanced manufacturing, chips, battery factories, and the like, also demanding lots of electricity. So, you know, again, it's lots of factors, but I would say the single most clear one to point to is the AI data center dynamic that is just coming in and being very chunky, right? When you're talking about 500 megawatts, a gigawatt, 2 gigawatts at a time, and these facilities coming online in 12, 18, 24 months, it's undeniable that that's a big driver.
That is chunky indeed. So my question then is, how can utilities and regulators adequately plan and prepare for that kind of chunky impact?
It really runs counter to the way utilities are going to typically plan, right? Typically, utilities think about big load growth over the course of a 5 or 10 year horizon. And a lot of that load growth is driven by economic cycles, right? That you're like, all right, well, we think we're going into a growth economic cycle. So there's certain assumptions you make about load growth. Or, you know, utilities might have visibility into a large factory that's being built. But typically, again, those are going to take 5, 6, 7 years to build. The challenge with data centers has been they've come online so quickly because of the economic imperative of, I have to get the thing built as quickly as I can because the demand for compute is so great. So it really has strained a lot of utilities' planning regimes and forced, in my opinion, some suboptimal outcomes from kind of the perspective of how you serve that load. I think one example is a really heavy reliance on backup generation as prime power. So typically a large load, a data center, will have backup gas or backup diesel. If the grid goes down, they want to maintain uptime. But there's been a bit of a shift to a dynamic of relying on that backup power as prime power. So prime power is, it is the resource that is allowing the data center to be brought online, because the assumption is that backup power source is going to operate more regularly and thus mitigate congestion, mitigate constraints on the grid. Those are dirty technologies. Those are expensive technologies. And so we're seeing gigawatts, potentially tens of gigawatts of expensive, dirty backup power being relied on as prime power to connect these data centers. And I think we don't fully understand the economic consequences for consumers of the reliance of on this expensive backup generation as prime power. So I think that's one of the examples of a fairly suboptimal set of outcomes. I'd say another example of the suboptimal outcomes is not really getting cost allocation right. So when a large load comes online, there's a whole set of investments that need to be made in infrastructure to support that large load. Substation upgrades, line extensions, and the like. And the typical rate-making regime that most utilities operate under would be one where those costs are spread across all consumers, either all consumers or certain subsets of consumer types. So the implication is, in the near term, rates rise when you have a new very large load connect, but the premise is over time that large load is going to pay its own share. But these loads have been so big that that effect has been magnified. And so that has had upward pressure on rates for all consumers, which is creating, I'd say, a lot of tension in lots of parts of the United States. Now, that's something that lots of utilities and lots of regulatory regimes are working to fix. But the speed at which this load has come online has meant that the regulatory system has been very much stressed.
Yes, unfortunately, there is often a regulatory lag. Sometimes policy takes a while to catch up to the reality of a situation. And as you say, these large data center loads are coming online so quickly. But how do we turn these large loads into part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem?
In principle, the medium-term solution for affordability is going to be increasing network utilization, right? It is economically accurate to say that spreading more megawatt hours or kilowatt hours over the same amount of infrastructure will have a downward pressure on rates, because utilities collect revenue on, generally at least, volumetrically. And if you can push your system from, you know, what's typical today to a 40 or 50% utilization system to a 60 or 70% utilization system, it's the same CapEx base or potentially a slightly larger CapEx base, but significantly more volume through that CapEx, more revenue, similar rate base, lower rates for all consumers. That's the promise of large loads. So we do have to think about a couple things. One, it's how do we ensure that large loads are being operated in a manner to drive higher utilization? How do we design the system that we need to build to connect these large loads under this framework of we want to drive more utilization? And I think this is what's so much part of the Octopus Energy story here in the US, and that is how do we partner with utilities and large loads to harness load flexibility across the consumer base to orchestrate load that is not just at the data center, but across residential and commercial households to drive higher utilization and actually use resources, investments from large loads like data centers to make investments in households to drive higher utilization. So case in point being, how do you partner with a large data center to deploy energy storage at scale across residential and small commercial households and businesses? Those batteries can charge when there's slack in the network, discharge when there's a constraint, increase utilization, lower bills for consumers, allow the data centers to connect more quickly, and you create a win-win, right? Data center connects fast, rates go down for all consumers, you don't rely on dirty backup generation as prime power, and now we have a cheaper, better system than we had before.
Nick, that almost sounds utopian. And of course, I'm not an expert, but I can at least identify the fact that there are several moving parts to that equation. So how do we make that happen realistically?
It's not as far-fetched as you might think. We have the technology to do the orchestration at Octopus. It's something that we do all the time. You know, in the United Kingdom today, we connect hundreds of thousands of electric vehicles and batteries, and we orchestrate those devices both against day-to-day needs of the consumer to help lower their costs of charging or their bills. But we also have them available to meet grid constraints. When national grid has a massive challenge related to, say, an outage of a connector to Europe, we can instantaneously dispatch these hundreds of thousands of connected devices to solve that problem. So it's a software challenge. The software exists. It's in production, operating at scale within the Octopus ecosystem. Certainly, there are other companies that are doing it as well. Energy storage is a mature technology. We're not looking for some new storage technology or some new storage measure that doesn't yet exist that's going to allow us to scale deployment into households. There are hundreds of thousands of energy storage systems being deployed every year across the United States. You know, states like California, states like Texas are seeing lots and lots of consumers adopt storage today. The challenge, I think, is more a regulatory framework. This is not the way regulators and market rules have been set up historically. Our energy markets and infrastructure planning are very much oriented towards supply moving one direction from generation to the consumer and infrastructure being built around sort of assumptions around what load is going to look like, not sort of dynamic control of load that can influence how infrastructure is built. In a world where these things are much more dynamic and there's a lot more ability to control when and how consumers use electricity, we have to change the way we plan. Again, the tools exist to facilitate that change planning framework, and we're seeing distribution operators like UK Power Networks, for instance, actually very actively doing it. And utilities here in the US too are starting to think about non-wires alternatives and flexibility as a scalable solution. Xcel Energy is a great example in Minnesota. They're deploying energy storage at commercial industrial sites in a distributed fashion to help them balance congestion on their network and support large loads that are being connected. So it's really just taking what we have, the capabilities, but are really being deployed in pockets, coalescing around this as a broader solution, and then pushing forward some simple, no regrets regulatory enhancements to empower utilities to do more of this. Because I think that's a big part of it. From my perspective, it's not that utilities in the US or in Europe don't want to engage with load flexibility. It's that they don't feel like they have the permission from their regulators to do so. And the speed at which demand is coming, they don't feel like they can go to a regulator and wait 2 years for a new set of rules and new regulatory regime to come into play to be able to connect these large loads. So they're using the tools they already have in their toolbox, which are probably not the best tools for consumers or the grid. So how do we deconstrain these utilities from, you know, kind of doing things the way they've always done things and allow them to do things in a bit of a different but perhaps better way and, you know, iterate quickly?
Are these regulatory hurdles or barriers a federal issue, or is this determined by state policy? Help me understand that.
Most U.S. electricity regulation is state policy. And so there are certain dynamics that can be addressed at the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But in my opinion, the vast majority of the work that needs to be done is state by state, which also creates a bit of a challenge, right? That means that you have to go state by state or transmission operator by transmission operator. So MISO, PJM, CAISO, those are the RTOs in the US, and think about their market rules. And so you might have a market rule that governs capacity and energy, but then when you think about infrastructure planning, those rules are typically going to be governed at the state level by the regulatory commission. And then you have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that has some levels of oversight around transmission planning, especially interstate transmission planning. So that is a challenge, right? Is that you have state by state, regional markets, and federal oversight, and they all have an interplay. And so you can't go to just one and hope to see a change that scales across the United States. You have to be active in lots of different places. But I think fundamentally, there is an opportunity at the state level to make a lot of enhancements that can lead to significant scaling up of consumer load flexibility as a solution for load growth and congestion. And I'll give one specific type of example. So today, most US utilities make fairly significant investments in demand side management. Those investments typically are governed by their state regulator, and they are articulated through a variety of programs that the utilities implement. They might have a thermostat program. They might have an electric vehicle managed charging program. They might have a battery program. They might have a heat pump program. But each one of those programs exists in a silo with its own budget, its own measurement of effectiveness, and the like. And because they exist in silos, we don't think about the co-optimization as effectively as we should across each of those devices. Because in the end, from a consumer perspective, I care about my bill. I don't care about one device in my home versus another device. I really care about all of my devices and how it affects my comfort, the utility of using these things, and how much it costs. And so what we need to do is move towards more of a whole home approach to consumer load flexibility. And that's just not the way these programs have been developed over the years. And so there's a theory of regulatory change that we just need to say, look, we're not going to push the individual programs anymore. We're going to allow utilities to think about things more comprehensively, more whole home, more multi-asset, which is starting to happen. But that's very much at the state level, right? So we need to go state by state and really encourage regulators to allow utilities to engage with consumer load flexibility on a multi-asset and whole home approach.
I'd like to pivot slightly, Nick, and ask you about the use of existing grid assets and how we use them more effectively. I realize that the existing grid is aging. So how then do we use these assets more effectively? And obviously we need to keep investing in new infrastructure, but surely there's more we can do with what we have.
I think it really is going to depend on the location, right? There are going to be places in the grids where we are going to have to build new infrastructure. And, you know, if you think about the age of the grid in the United States in particular, many networks are 30, 40, 50 years old. So there's just maintenance and new infrastructure build that we're going to have to do. And it is far too difficult in the US to build, say, new transmission lines. We need more transmission to connect new generation, particularly new clean generation. But I think we don't want to think about new infrastructure reflexively as the only solution, because getting to the earlier part of our conversation around affordability, one of the key ways to drive a lower cost grid is to increase utilization. So if we're constantly just building new infrastructure ahead of demand coming, we're not going to get at that utilization challenge. If we don't get at the utilization challenge, we're not going to structurally get at consumer costs. So I think it's a bit of a circumstance-dependent situation of, you know, does a new transmission line or a big substation upgrade make sense in that particular context? Or is there an opportunity to rely on load flexibility as a way to, at the very least, delay the build of the new infrastructure to allow more load to come in so that when the infrastructure is built, there are more megawatt hours to spread over that infrastructure cost?
Do you believe that grid congestion is hindering the advancement of renewable energy in the US?
It's undoubtedly causing some economic challenges. I don't know that it's the fundamental blocker for infrastructure like new solar and new wind and large-scale batteries to be built. But in certain markets where you have lots of solar already online, congestion is causing higher costs, and those costs can be to the generator or the consumer, depending on, you know, how things are structured. And we're stranding low-cost megawatt hours. So I would say it's more a function of, could we be lowering bills if we were getting at congestion by unlocking more clean energy? Yes. And lowering bills is one of our primary mandates and, you know, frankly, one of our primary imperatives for how we think about architecting and operating a system. But I don't know that it's a fundamental blocker to lots of clean energy being built.
Nick, this might be a tough question, but we've been looking at various objectives such as driving decarbonization. We're looking to lower consumer bills. We're aiming for dynamic load control. So we're looking at the whole ecosystem here. If you could select three action items that you believe would make a tangible difference towards driving this agenda, what would those action items be?
So thematically, we at Octopus have very strong conviction that energy storage is going to be one of, if not the single most important tool to solve congestion and get at sort of the core affordability challenge for consumers. The cost of energy storage continues to fall. And the idea that you're at some point in the near term going to have a battery in every home, whether it's in the EV or as a standalone, does not seem far-fetched. And then we're just talking about residential as a category being relatively flat. And that flatness is going to allow for a lot of new load to come online, and it's going to bring down costs. So I'd say, how do we really allow energy storage to capture the full value and thus, you know, justify consumer investment? That to me would be the sort of top priority. Tactically, you know, that means giving people the full credit for the export of a energy storage device. So in a home, you might have a 5 or 10 kilowatt battery, and the peak demand for that home may only ever be 5 or 6 kilowatts. So the battery has larger peak ability to charge and discharge than the demand for the home. how do you give the battery full credit as a demand response resource instead of saying, hey, we're only going to let you take credit for the coincident peak of the home? So thus saying, if a 10 kilowatt battery, we're only going to give it credit as a capacity resource for 4 kilowatts because that's the peak demand for the home. So allowing residential distributed batteries to fully participate at their full nameplate capacity is really important. And in states like California, they have not allowed that yet. So I think that's a big unlock. I'd also say that we need to think about connections and how do we facilitate the connections of these batteries. So we don't want to put overly stringent interconnection policies and blockers for consumers adopting these technologies. Expedited studies, deemed approvals. If you want to do it, it's an online process. You submit, it's approved same day. Instead of saying, oh, we're going to take a day, a week, a month in some cases to study what is a very small thing going into the home.
Nick, my final question to you, what would you say is the most rewarding part of your position at Octopus Energy? And perhaps a follow-up question to that is, how many plushies do you have at home or in your office?
As you've probably heard thematically, at Octopus Energy, we're really focused on how do we engage with consumers? And how do we build solutions that benefit consumers, lower their bills, increase their comfort? So the best part of my job is actually seeing that happen in practice, right? Seeing the delight of a consumer when their bill is now 10%, 15% lower because they have been able to install a battery or been able to sign up for one of our tariffs that is innovative. We have a customer in Texas that's been with us for quite some time who reached out to me recently and was wanting to provide feedback to say, hey, you know, I have a battery, I have an EV, I have a smart thermostat. I want to do more with those devices. How can I engage with Octopus to design new innovative tariffs? And that's music to my ears, right? Being able to actually talk to my customers, especially the ones who are really excited about sort of this prosumer model and partner with them to come up with ideas. That's the best part of my job by far. When it comes to plushies, I don't know, at any given time, you know, the storage boxes are actually in the office. So we have hundreds there. I probably have 4 or 5 kicking around, you know, between what's in my kid's room and what the dog has at any given day.
Well, I can neither confirm nor deny the existence of a plushie in my drawer at the office, but that's another story. Nick, it has been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Pamela. And thank you, everyone, for listening to what I have to say.
And thank you to our listeners. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Larg, and our producer, Rion Mostert. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.